I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Isabel Wilkerson, epic tale teller of the great migration of Southern blacks that remade America. Sound and spirit, north, south, east, and west in the 20th century. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is a global story in that the world has seen many mass migrations of very poor farm people, peasants, and serfs toward opportunity. In India and China today, more people migrate from village to city in 1 year than moved with our great migration over 50 years. More than 10 million in Asia every year now, fewer than 10 million in America between 1915 and 1970. That is from World War I to the end of the Civil Rights era, as Isabel Wilkerson has framed her story. But was there ever a migration that, beyond moving people, transformed a national culture as ours did? Songs, games, language, art, style, worship, every kind of entertainment, including pro sports. In fact, almost all we feel about ourselves, how we look to the world, changed in the sweep of this story. Isabel Wilkerson, you're getting so much praise for this book, The Warmth of Other Suns, but I want to add my admiration and thanks. It is a magnificent work, and it's changing me too, Isabel.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm getting ahead of your story, but can we just lay it down here that great swaths of pop and serious culture, the culture I grew up in and my children as well, was fruit of your story. Jazz and its stars like Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Illinois Jacquet, the Basie and the Ellington Bands, stars like Johnny Hodges, whose family moved from Virginia to Boston very early in this century, so many more, Ray Charles, Mahalia Jackson, gospel music, rhythm and blues, the Motown sound, sports immortals like Bill Russell and Jackie Robinson. They're all players in the story. Writers, actors, comedians, Toni Morrison, Spike Lee, Miles Davis, Michelle Obama, they're all children of the Great Migration. Let's listen to Ray Charles singing Georgia, written by Hoagy Carmichael, a white guy, but it's sort of a universal hymn to nostalgia.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through,
the whole day through.
Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you,
a song of you,
comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines.
When you mention high art, for example, the idea of Toni Morrison, who's a perfect example of this. Toni Morrison's parents were raised in Alabama. They decided they wanted their daughter to go to school and to grow up in the North. They moved to Lorain, Ohio, where she had the opportunity to go to better schools, integrated schools, and to a library. African Americans during a great portion of the 20th century were not able to even walk into a library and take out a book. Where would she be had her parents not had the foresight and the courage to take her out, where she would have the opportunity to read and read and read, take out books, and then to go on to become a Nobel laureate? It's unfathomable. The names
where would we be?
Stupendous. Where would we be? James
Where
Baldwin.
Would we be without Coltrane?
Just in the literature, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, August Wilson, the playwright, Lorraine Hansberry, another playwright. These people, essentially, their entire art was built around an attempt to understand the Great Migration as they saw it, as the children of this migration. It's overwhelming when you think of just high art. Then when you get to music.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline. Why can't you be true? You just started doing the thing you used to do.
Connect Chuck Berry to the migration.
Well, Chuck Berry also came up from the South, and he ended up being connected with Chess Records in Chicago and recorded for them. And in some ways, this is an example of the transfer of folk music from the South with the rhythms of the North, the metabolism that's sped up. You can hear that it's a sped up version, very urban, very fast paced. And he became a representative, too, of how it mutated in some ways. The art form mutated to become a whole new art form. And he was one of the, you know, the early participants in rock and roll, which also crossed the Atlantic and came back to us in the form of the Rolling Stones or Eric Clapton and many others.
I think it was Clapton who said about rock and roll, they could have just called it Chuck Berry.
Music, as we know it, would simply not be what it is had there not been the Great Migration. For example, Motown simply wouldn't exist. And that's because Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, his parents were raised in Georgia. They moved to Detroit, where he grew up. When he became a young man, he decided he wanted to go into the music industry. He didn't have the resources to go scouting all over the country. He looked around himself in the neighborhood where he happened to be, and he saw around him, you know, young people, Diana Ross, whose parents migrated from different parts of the South. The Temptations had all come up from Alabama. Aretha Franklin, her parents came up from the South. The Jackson Five, their mother came from Alabama and their father from Arkansas. They met in the North and then had nine children, who all of whom were musical prodigies, essentially, and changed the face of music as we know it. Prince, often not thought of because his father migrated from Louisiana to Minnesota, which was the far end of that migration north along the midsection of the country. It is hard to imagine American music without this migration having occurred. And we haven't even gotten to the issue of jazz, which you mentioned earlier.
Could we listen to just a little bit of Miles Davis's So What from the Kind of Blue album? Is so special, even more so every day somehow. Who is he to you?
Well, he's a legend, and he could not possibly have reached the full realization of his genius had his parents not had the foresight to leave Arkansas, cotton country of Arkansas. However, he also was the beneficiary of the music of the South, because one of the great things about the great migration is that it transferred the blues, the spirituals, gospel, the folk music of the South, which had an opportunity to grow in with the metabolism of the North and become a new art form, new art forms in general, rhythm and blues, jazz. And he's a perfect example of one of the best-known people who ever participated in this and benefited.
It's phenomenal. If we talked about sports figures, we'd be here all day and night for weeks. But there are so many important ones. For me, Bill Russell, as a Bostonian, I mean, 13 years in the NBA, 11 national championships. I had not realized, because we thought of him as coming from San Francisco, I had not realized that Bill Russell, too, is a child of the migration from Monroe, Louisiana, where another of your central characters comes from. But dilate a little bit on the great Bill Russell.
Bill Russell would not be who we know him to be had there been no Great Migration, had his parents not had the courage to leave. His parents were having a very rough go of it in Monroe, Louisiana. They lived under a caste system. This Great Migration was essentially a defection. It was a seeking of political asylum, in a way, from a caste system that controlled their every move. From the moment they woke up in the morning to the moment they went to bed, their every movement was determined by this caste system known as Jim Crow. And Bill Russell's family experienced some of the harsh realities of that. And one story involving Bill Russell father involves a day where Bill Russell's father was just wanting to get gas. And the custom in the Jim Crow South was that when an African-American was in line for something, any white Southerner who came up could cut in line and go before that person. So he had been in line for a while, and it turned out that one white motorist after another showed up, got in front of him, and he had to wait, and he had to wait, and he had to wait. Eventually, he decided he would just back out and make the decision to maybe drive the other half hour to the next gas station and where he might be able to get served. As he was beginning to back out, the owner of the gas station stopped pumping gas for the white motorist he was working with and got a shotgun, held it to Bill Russell's father's head, and said, "You'll leave when I tell you to leave. Don't ever let me see you trying that again." His mother, Bill Russell's mother, was around the same time stopped on the street because she was dressed in her Sunday clothes, which she had worked very hard to save for. And a police officer stopped her and said, "You go home right now and take that off. That is not what a colored woman should be wearing." She had to go home. She was told that if she was seen in that again, she would be arrested. Bill Russell came home. He was about 8 or 9 years old, and he saw his mother crying at the kitchen table. The family decided that they would leave Monroe, Louisiana, a very difficult decision, for a faraway place, Oakland, California. And it was there that Bill Russell had the opportunity to go to integrated schools, to be able to go to an NCAA school. He would never have had the opportunity to do that had they stayed in the South. He ended up leading the Dons of the University of San Francisco to 2 NCAA championships, and then, of course, came to the attention of the Celtics, where he helped lead that team to 11 championships out of the 13 years he was there. Basketball, but would not be what we know it to be had this Great Migration not occurred. And he's but one person out of this entire experience of 6 million people who migrated.
Isabel Wilkerson is my guest. She's made it her 15-year project to understand a 50-year migration of black people out of the South to places like New York, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and California. It was a search, in her title, for the warmth of other suns. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude. Isabel Wilkerson is our guest. The Warmth of Other Suns is her account of a leaderless 50-year revolution. At the start in 1915, 9 out of 10 black Americans lived in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, half of black America lived someplace else. Isabel Wilkerson won a Pulitzer Prize for her New York Times reporting. She now teaches journalism at Boston University. There are so many parables here, Isabel Wilkerson, and I just want to get to a few of them. And the extraordinary thing about your book is that each story is different. Each person had to decide on their own, kind of in isolation, that they'd had enough, or this was the moment to go, or that it was worth it. They argued it out, you know, couples and families entirely on their own over a 50-year period. It's an amazing story. I want to get to the three lives that you followed in the most extraordinary detail. Ida Mae Gladney, George Starling, Ida Mae Gladney being a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi, George Starling being a fruit picker in Orange Blossom, Florida, who ends up coming north and working on the railroad, and then Robert Pershing Foster, coming from relative privilege, goes to Los Angeles as a doctor. He saves Ray Charles's career in a certain way with a surgery when Ray needed it bad, touched any number of other lives. But where's to begin? I mean, we'll never cover the whole of it, and yet the theme of talent being given a chance and then blossoming in the most spectacular, historic ways runs through this whole book.
Well, I am moved by the idea that this was a leaderless revolution. In other words, there was no one who told these people to make this decision. There was no one who set the day and the time as to when people would go. And these people, in isolation, decided that it was time to go. Ida Mae Gladney, who was, as you said, the wife of a sharecropper, they left because a cousin had been wrongly accused of a theft he had not committed. And when, after her husband had seen what had happened to his cousin, he was beaten to within an inch of his life. And after that, her husband came home and said to her, "This is the last crop we're making." They left Mississippi at night without having told anyone except her mother that they were leaving, and they headed to the Midwest, ultimately landing in Chicago. So that was one.
Introduce George Starling, an obsessively interesting man, tragic in certain ways, but a fighter from conception, it would seem.
It would seem. He had a brief time of being able to go to college, which only made him, I think, more frustrated than anything else. And he was forced to return to picking citrus, which was the primary industry in his part of Florida. Once he got there, because he'd had some education, and he was quite smart, actually, he was valedictorian of his high school class, segregated though it was, he ended up having tremendous frustration over the fact that the work was dangerous and the pay was worse. And he began to lead efforts among these pickers to do work stoppages in order to get a nickel more per box, one nickel more per box for boxes that were ultimately going to go for $3 or $4 on the open market. And it turned out that he had to flee for his life because of threats against his life. He headed to Harlem as a result of those threats. And he ended up working the railroad where he saw the migration unfold before him on the Silver Comet and the Silver Spur and the other trains going back and forth, the migration trains, you might call it. And then finally, we have Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who had served his country in the Korean War, had served as a surgeon for the Army. When he got out, however, it turned out he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana, again the home of Bill Russell. And he set out on a course for California, as had Bill Russell's parents. He found that it was a treacherous journey, one he had not anticipated being so difficult. He ended up having to drive three states without rest because he could not find a place that would give him a room.
You drove that route yourself. He did it in a Buick Roadmaster in 1951, I think it was. El Paso was a great, difficult crossing. For you, what were the most treacherous moments in that ride west in the 1950s, yesterday?
Yes, well, I made the journey, you know, well after that, when we could have stopped anywhere we wanted to. I had my parents in the car with me. They were migrants themselves. They had migrated from the South to Washington, D.C., and they were retired by then and always up for an adventure. And we set out on a course with the caveat that I had to be the one driving. But then we got to the dangerous part of the journey where I knew, based on his you know, multiple descriptions of the trip to me that he could not stop. We were taking hairpin curves along the base of the Rocky Mountains. You're on two-lane roads. There were no guardrails. In those days, there were for me. But in any case, we ended up making it as far as Yuma, Arizona, and I felt such tremendous empathy for what he had had to go through because we had no trouble at all at the time that we went, which was around 2000, and we had no trouble finding a place at all. He, of course, had not had that luxury in the early 1950s, and he had had to drive all the way through. It's a miracle he made it at all. This was very much the reality for any African American making the crossing at that era. There really simply were no places for them to stop. There was extreme segregation to the degree that there were these green books that people had to turn to in order to give them clues as to where they might stay. They were kind of like a AAA map that would give them suggestions as to where they might stay. They had to essentially plan for the idea that they might not be able to stop. They had to be able to ensure that they had enough water and ice for the radiator if it overheated. They needed to make sure they had enough food to last them for the long trip. They often carried their Bibles with them to read the 121st Psalm, which was a prayer to protect basically pilgrims who were making some long journey. They really were on their own. This was before GPS. It was before cell phones. It's actually quite frightening to think about what they had to undergo in order to just get to these receiving stations of the North and West.
It was, in every sense, a kind of underground railroad in modern times.
I call it the overground railroad.
No wonder there are so many train songs. I think of Duke Ellington's train songs, there are lots of them, including Take the A-Train, but Daybreak Express, for example.
Even if they didn't take the train, it became a symbol of the way of getting out, and it became the determining factor of where people would go because they were following the routes of the trains, following the routes of the buses, and ultimately those trains determined where people would ultimately go. These were not haphazard arrivals. These people were following very set routes to a different place from wherever they happened to be in the South.
Isabel Wilkerson, you write a wonderful line about the migration as the first big step the nation's servant class took without asking. But it was not without brutal pressure in almost all of these stories, as you said, of lynching or direct threats of murder or imprisonment. Could we listen to Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, which was, of course, about lynching?
For the
During the decades leading up to the Great Migration and following into the Depression, there was a lynching every 3 days in some part of the South. So the strange fruit that she described would have been a more common sight than one might think. One historian said that to have been black in the South during that era would have meant that all of them, almost all of them, would have either known someone in their town who had been lynched or would have heard of someone nearby who had been lynched. It would have been impossible to avoid hearing about that growing up in the South at that time.
Hmm. What was the Wilkerson family story in all this?
Yes.
Your own mother and father?
My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia to Washington, D.C. at the end of World War II as a young woman. And she went to Howard University, where she met my father, who was a Tuskegee Airman, and he had come up from Southern Virginia. So they would never, ever have met had there been no Great Migration. I grew up around people who were all the children of people from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia. I was surrounded by the Great Migration, yet no one called it that. And my parents got me at a school that was on the other side of the park, meaning an integrated school, and she went to a great deal of trouble in order to get me there. She actually made arrangements with a cab company to take me across town to this school where there were many, many children from who were the children of senators and children of ambassadors. So they were, in many respects, immigrant children. And I really found that I had so much in common with the children of the immigrants. And that was because we all had food that our mothers had prepared for our lunchboxes that was so different from the food of the people who'd been there for so much longer. I had this obsession with liverwurst on pumpernickel for a long time because my mother never prepared that for me. In fact, a poet in the South described me as a Southerner once removed because in some ways I felt very much like the child of an immigrant.
You're very, shall we say, generous about connecting this story with all the other immigrations that have formed this country. I mean, what are the common threads, and in what sense is the Great Migration completely a story unto itself?
Well, it's completely a story unto itself because it happened within the borders of this country, and the people who were participants in it were, in fact, American citizens who should not have had to have crossed mountains and gone halfway across the country to experience the privileges that come with being American, the privileges which they were born to. There was no question that they had to leave a caste system that was so arcane that it made it illegal for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham, for example, or that there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in many courtrooms throughout the South.
Would you read that passage on page 113, in The Warmth of Other Suns, about the signals of control and the rules of the old white South?
Yes, any African American boarding a bus, and it was slightly different in each city or town as to how elaborate the dance was of just boarding a bus. Sometimes they would buy the ticket and then have to get off the bus and go to the back of the bus. Sometimes they could buy the ticket and then go straight through the white section in order to get to the black section. But either way, there was always some signal, some sign that would indicate this part of the bus is for whites, this part of the bus is for blacks. And on this particular bus that the protagonist, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, was boarding as he was heading north to St. Louis, they kept moving the sign as white people boarded, and only the white people could touch the sign. So if you would like me to read it,
please.
It reads, "Those white and colored shingles were as much a part of the southern landscape as cotton growing in the field. Each state and city had a different requirement or custom to signal how the races were to be separated and to what extent the races were to be divided. In North Carolina, white and colored passengers could not occupy, quote, contiguous seats on the same bench, unquote. Virginia prohibited the two races from sitting side by side on the same bench unless all other seats were filled. Several states required that the placard saying white or colored be, quote, in plain letters, not less than 2 inches high. In Houston, the race to which the seat belonged was posted on the back of the seat. In Georgia, the penalty for willfully riding in the wrong seat was a fine of $1,000 or 6 months in prison. Colored passengers were assigned to the front of the rail car on the train, but to the rear of other conveyances, too. In the words of the mayor of Birmingham, do away with the, quote, disagreeable odors that would necessarily follow the breezes.
So what does the Great Migration have in common with the Irish, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans, Jews, you name it?
I really believe that one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that many of the groups that were converging in these big cities of the North, these great dream cities of that attracted so many people from all over the world and from the southern part of the United States, the tragedy was that the people were essentially the same. Many of them were people of the land, people who had worked the land, people who were coming from small towns, often repressive caste systems that they were from which they were seeking freedom in the new world of America as we know it. And yet when they arrived, one group was allowed to join the unions, recruited to join the unions. Others were brought in as strike breakers. Some were allowed to live in many, many different neighborhoods of their choosing. Others were limited to particular already overcrowded sections that became ghettos. They never imagine all the wonderful and amazing things, relationships and friendships and alliances that could have been made had these people not been torn apart and rendered rivals as opposed to people who might have worked together and made friendships and had greater understanding. Perhaps some of the violence that attended the arrival of the migrants to the North might not have occurred had there been a greater understanding that they were all the same people and had so much more in common. Any immigrant who makes this journey is different from those who stay, by definition. They are more likely to be risk takers. They are less patient with the status quo. They're less likely to be able to accept the repression of the place that they're leaving. They're more likely to be able to say, I can make the break from all that I've known for a place that I've never seen, even without the guarantees and hopes that life will be better. That is the classic American story.
And in my case, it was illiterate Irish peasants from the West in Galway who arrived around 1895 and signed with an X. I mean, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing. It is the classic American story. And if people recognize it, when they said that, you know, when the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, half were living outside of the South, this great arc from Boston to over to Chicago and then over to the West Coast down to Los Angeles. And that means that the majority of African Americans that you meet, just as when you think of the a majority of Americans that you might meet, all were descended from people who came from someplace far away, far from where they happen to be. And often these forebears met someone that they would have otherwise never met, created a whole new lineage in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, in Los Angeles, and started whole new family lines, which is how you get a Michelle Obama.
We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, the journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. I'm Christopher Lydon. We'll be right back.